We got to work on that.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Wednesday, July 13th, 2016. The time is 1:38 p.m. With me at the table this afternoon, Senator Olson, welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman. Senator Kelly.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy.
Good afternoon.
Myself, Senator McKinnon. Online, Senator Bishop.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Senator Michikee. Senator Michikee should be joining us shortly. Is there anything to come before the Senate Finance Committee before we begin? Seeing and hearing none, Senate Bill Number 5005, an act relating to oil and gas production tax, tax payments and credits relating to oil and gas lease expenditures and production tax credits for municipal entities relating to interest applicable to delinquent taxes and providing for an effective date is before us. If I could invite Ken Alper to the microphone and Jenny Rogers from the Department of Revenue, our audit master from the Tax Division. Off-net, Commissioner Hoffbeck, are you there?
I am, Madam Chair.
Welcome to Senate Finance. Welcome, Director Alper. I see we have a PowerPoint presentation. That document is available online under the Senate website page, Senate Finance website page. Mr. Alper, if you could introduce yourself. And then if we swap between speakers, for those that are following us off-net or online, if you could identify yourself. It is nice that there's maybe a contrast in voices, but if you could identify yourself to the public, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this microphone is not terribly bendy. I hope it's picking up my voice. For the record, my name is Ken Alper. I'm the Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. I want to introduce to the committee a new member of our team that hasn't spoken to you before. This next to me is Jenny Rogers. She is an audit master. She's been with the Tax Division for 28 years with the Production Tax Group. And this is her first time before a legislative committee. So since we're here in Anchorage where she lives and works, I thought it would be a good idea to bring her with me for both technical and moral support.
Mr. Alper, is it Janie or Jenny?
Yeah.
Mike.
Janie and
why? Thank you very much.
She should put herself on the record to say that.
And for the record, I'm Jenny Rogers, R-O-G-E-R-S. There's the B.
Welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm just going to move into the presentation, if that's all right by you. We have before you Senate Bill 5005. It's one of the governor's new bills for the new special session. It has a relatively short and simple title. A similar slide when we introduced House Bill 247 was almost 275 words long, so it's nice to have a short title. It's a fairly straightforward bill. We were calling it a smaller and more targeted tax reform and minimum tax package. Far simpler than the previous bill that was passed through the legislature in the previous session. It does a few things. It addresses the so-called North Slope net operating loss issue that we discussed at great length previously. It brings up some of the smaller parts of Senate Bill 247. Madam Chair, should I pause?
Please, we have a question. Senator Dunleavy.
Through the Chair, just for clarification, this is not. This goes beyond tax credits, is what I'm hearing you say. This is going into tax policy, correct?
Through the Chair, Senator Dunleavy, yes, and we'll be getting into the specific provisions. There's issues in this bill that affect the minimum tax and how it's calculated, so that's a bit beyond the subject of purely tax credits.
Madam Chair, can I continue?
Senator Dunleavy.
Just from your perspective, administration's perspective, so this is going into what we refer to as SB 21, beyond tax credits.
Through the Chair, Senator Dunleavy, yes, it goes into the tax system. We had some of these conversations earlier in the session. We have stayed away from the core provisions of Senate Bill 21, the tax rate, the pro-rail credit, that sort of thing. Really, by addressing the minimum tax, which is a piece of statute that's been around since PPT, it's some of the residual older oil and gas tax law rather than the parts that were put into Senate Bill 21. But yes. Is beyond the world of credit.
Okay, thank you. I just need clarification. Thanks.
Mr. Alper, is there a reason why you would reintroduce several of the smaller measures when we've already denied those?
Madam Chairman, the governor, in going through the sort of post-mortem for House Bill 247, we walked through the different provisions, and He felt it was important to bring them back up. He thought that they were an important part of the overall reform package. They sort of fit together with the rest of what we're trying to do. So sometimes the third time's the charm, I guess.
Mr. Alper, we'll see.
Once again, get into much greater detail on these smaller provisions. I mentioned in my answer to Senator Dunleavy's question that we're getting into the minimum tax, the so-called floor, and how it's calculated and treated, and a couple of technical fixes that hopefully won't be terribly controversial. The things that came up late in the practice, in the process, it was too late to fix with House Bill 247 that we'd like to get fixed if we're going to move them in the bill. Otherwise, we'll do our best to fix them through the regulatory process. So I'm on now slide number 4, and this is a format that I've used before through the previous sessions. I've updated it now that we're pretty much through fiscal year 16. The books are not 100% closed, but I can say that, as you're aware, the governor a year ago limited the credit to $500 million for last year. We're going to come in very close to that number. I mean, it's going to be $498, $499, something like that, I think, by the time they finish up FY16. When you add that to the previous history, just about $8 billion has been put into tax credits in the so-called tax credit era of Alaska's history, going back 10 years. Of that, the great bulk of it is on the North Slope, of course, with the majority credits used against tax liability by the major producers, the former 20% capital credit from ACES and the per barrel credit that many of you know as the sliding scale credit in Senate Bill 21 has added up to $4.4 billion of offset taxes. And then $2.3 billion in refunded credits. Those are the new producers, the explorers, the developers. Of the $500 million that was spent last year, a little over $200 million were in that category, and a little less than $300 million were outside the North Slope.
Pepper, if you could pause before we move from the slide so I can see if we have questions, that would be helpful. Questions from committee members? I have several. On FY 2017 through FY16, we've issued $8 billion worth of credits. And I know that when we issue a credit, we don't receive revenue on the same time period that we issue the credit. But under the same time period, how much additional or how much revenue came in from the oil and gas industry, at least through production, if not combined? Whatever your credits are attached to, on the $8 billion, what did Alaska see in the form of revenue?
Madam Chair, I wish I brought that slide with me. We documented all of that in the previous hearing before your committee during the prior session. The number was in the low 60s of billions of dollars with overall oil and gas revenue, royalties, production tax, corporate income tax. I think it was about $62 billion came in over that time period. Obviously, the great bulk of that was from legacy fields that were developed long ago, that are simply where the bulk of the oil and the money comes from, especially in a high price environment. We were making a lot of money from Prudhoe Bay, say, in 2008 through 2013, the prices were high. So a lot of money.
Yes, thank you. We just had asked you to provide the dynamics so that when we talk to the general public about what we're paying out, they understand the magnitude of what we're receiving as well. On the previous slide, Director Alper, you indicated that if you weren't able to accomplish some of the policies that are proposed in SB 5005, that you would go to the regulatory process and start implementing them through the regulatory process. Could you please identify as we go through here where you're going to make regulatory changes should the legislature deny a change in state statute?
Certainly, Madam Chair, and I assure you it's none of the big pieces. We're talking about technical language relating to, off the cuff, and we've talked about it before, that piece that deals with the pro-rationing of a producer that owns, that the utility that owns their own gas field and how their costs might get apportioned. There's a little bit of a technical issue with how that final language is written that we're hoping to clean up, but we believe we could probably resolve it through the regulatory process without doing anybody any harm. We're not going to make any big changes to tax law without going through the legislature. That would never happen.
Director Alper, I think that's perspective. If your tax credits aren't coming in, you might think that it was more important than if you were receiving tax credits based on what we do regulatorily. But again, if you would point those out, if you see something that you believe you have authority through regulation to to change that we don't address if we don't move forward the legislation. Just would be helpful so the general public knows where they might expect changes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would do that. There's about two places where I'll point that out as we get deeper into the presentation.
Thank you. Senator Donnelly.
Mr. Halber, before you continue, just to put context to the purpose of why you're introducing the bill, the administration's introducing the bill, and so we don't guess why. What is the purpose that you're hoping to accomplish? I understand it's changes in tax credit policy, and it would appear now NOL and some minimum tax issues. But what is the overall purpose? What's the goal of doing that? What are you hoping to accomplish? More revenue for the state, less spend for the state? What's the goal you're trying to accomplish through this bill?
Thank you, through the Chair, Senator Dunleavy. I'm happy to go there. It's important to view this bill in the context of the rest of the package that was introduced Monday at the beginning of the current special session. The governor introduced a package of bills for regular session, and we've been trying to move a comprehensive fiscal package, what we call the New Sustainable Alaska Plan. The statewide taxes, increases to some existing taxes, restructuring the permanent fund, and reforms to the oil and gas tax and credit system. It is still the governor's goal to pass the overall package. This is one component of the whole. There isn't a specific goal in oil and gas. There's a broader goal to pass a series of bills that put Alaska on a sustainable footing towards the future, given our much more constrained fiscal circumstances than there were 6 months ago. If you're looking at the specifics, what is this bill going to do? If you look at the fiscal note, it will save the state money. It will save the state in the neighborhood of $100, $150 million a year, and it will raise a little bit of money in some years, primarily through these minimum tax changes within a band of prices. It will bring in a little bit more money. But for the most part, this is a savings to the state of $100 million a year, $150 million a year, that will contribute to reducing our spending, reducing our budget deficit.
Just to follow up.
Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Mr. Halber. That's helping. So coming from an individual that has government in my entire career, and I've been here since the early 80s when oil has really taken off, and I've seen the benefits as an educator for schools, et cetera, for the state of Alaska. The question I have is, how does this bill ensure that we're going to have ongoing exploration, ongoing development, ongoing production to keep oil in the pipeline? You know, a lot has been said in the press that you have two camps, basically, those that are pro-oil, those that are pro-whatever. And I think we're all pro-Alaska, and we want to make sure that whatever policy we put in place helps Alaska in the short, mid, and long term. How does this approach ensure that we're going to have companies, small, big, whatever, wanting to come to Alaska to explore and then develop and then produce? How does this do this approach?
Through the Chair, Senator Dunleavy, we can't ensure anything, of course. We can't ensure anything. The state government, the executive and legislative branch cannot ensure, guarantee, or force that, for that matter. These are private companies. They make economic decisions based on their own best interest or their own perceived best interest. We can encourage, we can incentivize. Ultimately, a lot of things are going to govern what investments are made in Alaska. Probably the biggest issues that will govern that are the rocks that we have, and our resources are, for all accounts, excellent and highly desirable, and the price of oil, which is currently poor, and a lot of investments are not going to be made in the short term because of the price situation. Our taxes, our tax credits are our consideration, but they are not the consideration. We are, with this bill, reducing the state's participation in and incentives for these new players. So it's reasonable to say that we might get fewer of them, but that is only one consideration. The overarching question is, can we afford to provide the level of support we're currently providing?
And just stop, and I appreciate that. And some of us are just wondering, as we go into the future, if the administration sees that we're investment is dropping off and thus exploration and thus development and thus production, do you anticipate we would have further discussions on how to deal with that?
Richard Senator Dunleavy, yes, I do. I'm sure not just the current administration, but every administration, past and future, We'll be engaging with the oil industry. That is our primary industry. It's our bread and butter. We'll be looking to maximize our position as the state to develop our resources for the maximum benefit of the people, but also to make sure the maximum of them are developed, to make sure that the companies do the work we want them to do and develop those resources. If we see that we might go too far in one direction, I'm sure there'll be a movement to bring it back from whence we came. It's an inherently dynamic process, as we've seen from year to year. It's an issue we've seen the OEG taking up.
Thank you. Thank you, Director Alpern. Co-Chairman Kelly.
Hey, Mr. Alpern, good to see you again.
Yes.
I think as we go forward, it's important to describe the approach that you're taking versus maybe the approach that some of this table would take regarding the question of oil revenue. And I think the important thing from our perspective is that we look at this, and this is from conversations that we've had in the past at the table, is that what we're looking at is a revenue stream. And you're looking at an expense stream. And your opening comments, and I know there have been there's been changes in the taxing regime over the period of time, but essentially your opening comments and Senator McKinnon asked you to readdress was about the amount of revenue that we've gotten. So we've spent $8 billion on tax credits, and we've gotten $61 billion worth of revenue back for it. Most people would say, that's a pretty good deal. Then we realized that the tax regime that we had in the 2010-ish area, 9, 10, 11, probably was actually going in the wrong direction, that we were trying to extract as much revenue from the oil companies as we possibly could. We realized it was probably too much, and it was discouraging production and exploration, so we put in SB 21. And the people of Alaska voted to uphold SB 21 because they had a sense like we do that we're really talking about our revenue, and sometimes you have to invest to get more revenue. And I guess what the questions that you're going to get from some of the people on this panel, and most of the people on this panel, from if past history is any indication, is that we're talking about revenue and you're talking about expenses. And you're saying, oh, we're spending all this money. Yeah, but the amount that we're spending is getting us a whole bunch of money, and we can't lose sight of the fact that we need more production on the North Slope. My question to you is going to be the same as it was when we were down in June during the regular session. What of your bill is going to increase production? And what of your bill is it going to increase production? Is it going to leave production the same, or is it going to decrease production? And I think the answer is that we'll probably end up decreasing production. We may extract a little bit more money, but ultimately we're going to start tilting that production curve downward again. That's our concern. And so when we fire back at you and get into these debates, it's not over your numbers, because what I know of you is that if you add 2 + 2, you're probably going to get 4, and I can trust that. I would disagree sometimes whether 2 and 2 are the two things that might need to be added, and that's what we're talking about here. So what I want to see from the governor is a tax regime or a credit regime that increases production, or if you have to make some changes, at least doesn't cause us to decrease it. And what I know of everything you guys have offered is that the danger lurks out there for us to decrease production, and that is not what we need right now. We should be in the business of trying to get more oil through that line. Ultimately, because of that, we'll get more money.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Kelly, I can't argue back and say this is going to increase production. Obviously, this is a bill that is reducing incentives to the oil industry. There's nothing inherently in there that's going to make them want to do more. The question is how much less, and is the cost-benefit analysis to the state of are we giving up more than we're gaining. I do want to push back a little bit on the $60 billion that you referenced that I answered Senator McKinnon's question earlier. these credits were put in place in large measure to invest in our future. During a time when we understood we had a large amount of money coming in from the industry, and we wanted to reinvest some portion of that towards really tomorrow's production. And you could see that, where we were getting $3, $4, $5, in some years $6 billion just from the production tax, and putting a few hundred million back into tax credits made a certain intuitive sense as a rational behavior towards the future. When the price has shrunk to the level where our revenue is well less than $1 billion, and not looking to be going back up in the near future, can we still afford the same level of investment in the industry when it's no longer a reinvestment of surplus profits, but almost entirely a diversion of the bulk of our revenue? And that's why, in some ways, the paradigm has shifted to where we need to look a little bit more aggressively at ramping back on our support for the industry, not out of any malice or desire to drive them away, but simply out of the fiscal reality that we don't believe we can afford the level of participation we've had in the past.
Senator Alpert, will we be seeing statistical analysis on where your proposal sets our tax regime in comparison to other sovereigns around the world and in comparison to other U.S. States? Because as I recall our conversation from several years ago when we looked at the current oil regime then, we were government, I shouldn't say just Alaska, but a government take overall was excessive from some's perspective. And we tried to balance our tax regime first nationally between Texas, North Dakota, Wyoming, and other sovereigns that had production. And we weren't so much looking at the goal of what it took to pay for state government. We were looking about how we could compete as a state against other national entities, other state structures. And then we went to a broader perspective and said, if we're competing with national, how are we looking internationally between Alaska and other nations as they move forward? And then there was a big fight on who we should compare ourselves to. Should we compare ourselves with Norway or otherwise? So, one, will we see statistical analysis on your proposal before this committee during this special session?
Madam Chair, as we spoke during the regular session, the Department of Revenue doesn't currently have the outside analysis on contract to provide that sort of work. Should we be continuing this conversation into the next regular session, we expect to do that. We recognize the legislature wants that from the administration, we will provide it. We have been in contact with the new consultant that's been hired by your own agency, by Legislative Budget and Audit. They have a new fiscal analyst. Mr. Meyer has unfortunately left, as you know. So he is putting together his package, his presentation, his modeling. And should the opportunity arise for him to present to your committee on this or other legislation, I believe he'd be bringing that sort of analysis to you. But we do not have it spun up. I could say that this bill is not touching upon the core government take issues that we were talking about. The comparable total government take percentage at different price points, that was the sort of mother analysis in SB 21. How do we measure up at $60, $100, $80, $120 oil? The credits were never part of that calculation, and they're not really part of that analysis. The changes in this bill are a tax increase between prices of around $55 and $80 a barrel, and more or less revenue neutral above $80 a barrel. So I don't think you're going to see a lot of movement from what was previously done and brought before you with SB 21.
Director Alpert, do you see a difference between tax credits and a net operating loss?
Madam Chair, I think I'd like to hear that question a little bit more broadly. I'm not sure I understood it.
Well, cashable tax credits, in the last special session, we passed a bill that removed about $400 million from available funds for the oil and gas industry, most specifically in the Cook Inlet region. The growth value was touched and the floor hardened a bit with allowable deductions on that. But net operating loss are like a federal income tax. If I submit my federal income tax and I have an expense that qualifies, it is a deduction. It's not a credit. It's a deduction on my federal taxes. So a net operating loss is allowable expenses. Tax credits are something that we're trying to incentivize something with, and this goes to Senator Dunleavy's question. Are we talking about how we're incentivizing or not incentivizing exploration in the state of Alaska, or are we talking about, and this goes to the structural change that I believe that we're here to talk about, and that is allowable deductions. Are we, do you see a difference between the two?
So, Madam Chairman, the net operating loss credit, a lot of the language that's in this bill is in some ways similar to what the House passed, what came to your committee at the beginning of it, late in the regular session. And it prevents operating loss credits, operating losses from being carried forward and used and turned into credits by the major producers. And I understand that that's a big and controversial step. It's important to, we're talking about Alaska's production tax. Alaska has a big, broad fiscal system related to oil and gas. A lot of the comparable countries that we look at have one tax. They've got some sort of sharing arrangement, some fixed percentage. Norway, you mentioned, that 78% is pretty much one thing. We here have a property tax, a corporate income tax, a royalty. There's a federal income tax coming at the end of the tail of all of this. Our royalty is a strictly gross tax. It's regressive at low prices. We have a corporate income tax, as is the federal government, that losses carry forward and are recaptured in a future year, and they get full value for that. Our production tax is something of a hybrid. It's not a pure income tax. It's not a pure royalty. It's a severance tax. So the Commissioner Hoffbeck's done a good job of explaining this. So we have a tax that's a net profits tax at high prices. As the prices get low and the minimum tax kicks in, it becomes a gross tax again. And then once you cross over this break-even point, which we purport to be around $45 a barrel, suddenly it becomes a net profits tax again in the negative. They get the full value of their loss at the 35% rate. And we view that as a little bit unbalanced. If we're at the gross, at a relatively small tax between 45 and 80, why should we be back to a net below 45? And then maybe the more appropriate thing to be to say, if you're losing money, there shouldn't be a tax, or there should be a very small minimum tax, but you shouldn't be allowed to go negative and carry those losses forward, specifically for the production tax. And no one is questioning the ability to carry forward losses within the corporate income tax, of course. That's a very different kind of tax.
Director Opper, can you remind me, does the 35% net operating loss drop to a 25% at a particular point in time, or does it stay 35% out into our future right now?
Madam Chair, it remains 35%. The bill that passed the other body and came to you did ramp it down towards 25, but that did not stay in the version that Senate Finance passed out.
So there were other, I know, that I'm trying to recall, because we've had many proposals in front of us, there are some tax credits that go away in 17 that were extended under the bill that we just passed.
Madam Chair, on the North Slope in particular, there were no material changes to the credits themselves. The capital credit had been previously eliminated as part of Senate Bill 21. The exploration credit was sunsetting and continued to sunset. The operating loss credit of 35% remains. There was the temporary bump to 45% for 2014-15 that was part of 21. That ramped down. What was extended to 17 was specifically of a frontier basin, the large 80% credit in the interior that, if you recall, the representative from OTMA speaking to the committee, they had a concern that they were going to miss a window, they lost their rig, so that credit was extended for a single year. But that was the only so-called short extension that was in HB 247.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Commissioner Hoffbeck.
For the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner Remner, I just wanted to add just one thing to the discussion. I think we need to keep in mind as we're talking about the net operating loss credits, they really come in two flavors. One is the way that they're used by the developers and the explorers, which is where they are truly credits. They're cash flow credits paid by the state, versus those that are being used by the producers and under the current tax regime where they're used as a write-off against revenues. And so, they really kind of reflect both sides of the question that you proposed. One is that they are a credit in one situation, and they are a deduction in the other.
Commissioner, thank you for that insight. Director Alcock, please continue.
Madam Chair, I was sort of halfway through slide number four, just going through a little bit of the history. Very little credits against tax liability outside the North Slope. That's because of the so-called tax caps, the very low maximum taxes that are in place that go back to the PPT bill of 2006. But a pretty robust amount of refunded credits, about $1.2 billion in refunded credits, primarily Cook Inlet, and the great majority of those in the last 3 or 4 years since the implementation of what was called the Cook Inlet Recovery Act, which passed in the 2010 session. So that's our $8 billion credit history. The more recent history, the work done since January, the bill was introduced with a set of expectations at the beginning of the last regular session. Those expectations changed with the spring forecast that came out in late March or April. So suddenly we started seeing, because of the extended period of low prices, large anticipated operating losses for our major producers. That changed the weather as far as how we calculated things. And we realized, because of the ability to use operating loss credits carried forward against the minimum tax, we suddenly started seeing literally zero minimum tax or near zero minimum tax, production tax for 2, 3, and 4 years into the future, rather than the roughly $150, $200 million that we had sort of banked on as the minimum tax payment, even in a low price environment. In that environment, we still saw FY17, which is something of a peak year, $775 million in expected demand for refunded tax credits. That was really about $575 of so-called new applicants and $200 million that were carried forward from the previous year's veto, and we discussed that in this committee and others over the previous session. But $775 was the demand. Meanwhile, when House Bill 247 passed, and there were many, many hearings, I might be lowballing it with 60, there were tremendous reforms, as you said, Madam Chair, to the Cook Inlet credits. They're being almost completely phased out by 2018. And also on the North Slope, the calculation and the application of the new oil provisions, the gross value reduction, were aggressively reformed. But the underlying credits, the operating loss and how they're treated on the North Slope, were not. Meanwhile, with the budget that passed the legislature this year, there were $460 million in tax credits. Of that, $30 million was from a statutory formula, regular general fund, and then $430 million was actually funded by other funding sources, generally supplemental, meaning FY16 funding sources, and they were tied to the fiscal note for the previous tax credit bill. The governor vetoed that additional $430 million, leaving only the $30 million from the formula. That means, of course, that we have only $30 million this year to be spent on $775 million worth of demand. Is going to be a large amount of tax credits carrying forward into FY18 if no additional action is taken. And there may be questions, Madam Chair. I would like, if you don't mind, to move to the next slide, which is a very data-heavy slide in this subject matter, and then if there are questions, we could be referring to that and how these carry forwards, how these numbers sort of work in our estimation. So this is an update to a slide that I brought to this committee earlier, and it looks at the idea of funding, well, several things here. The top half is history, the beginning of the credit era through the last fiscal year. What happened, and that actual credits claim, the third column is what happened, how much money we spent on tax credits, and then the next several columns go through the calculation of what would have happened had the legislature of days funded at the statutory formula, which was tied to 10 to 15% of production tax revenue. And you could see the about six or seven columns in it, this credit cap per AS 4355028C. That's what the appropriation would have been. And you'll notice, Madam Chair, that those numbers between FY09 and FY13 were actually larger than the amount that was spent on credits. In other words, had the formula appropriation taken place rather than a more we're just going to fund what they ask for type appropriation, what would have happened in effect would have been we would have endowed a fund. We would have built up an amount of set-aside money to fund tax credits. And then that end-year fund balance is the balance of that fund. It would have peaked at $655 million at the end of fiscal year 2013. Now, beginning in 2014, the revenue would be dropping off, but there would be the money in the fund. The demand is the demand, so we would have been spending down that fund. And that fund would have been pretty close to right there at the end of FY15. And then going into the last budget cycle a year ago, we would have been roughly the same place. We need to find money to pay for tax credits, only there wouldn't be the sort of cultural expectation that the legislature is going to fully fund the demand of tax credits every year. The expectation would be we're going to fund at the statutory formula. And then we wouldn't have had the same level of anxiety from short funding. But taking that logic forward to the bottom half of the slide, what would happen if we continue this process into the future? Now, I want to draw your attention to the blue numbers. The blue numbers are updated based on the passage of House Bill 247. So there were different and larger numbers there when I presented the same slide a month ago. So because of the changes, because of the cooking of tax cuts and some additional revenue from a couple of other calculations, we are going to be spending less money on tax credits, and we're going to have slightly smaller carried forward NOLs for the major producers in what now is current law, House Bill 247. So the demand next year, instead of 775, is down to about 760. The demand in FY18, which used to be 500, is now 445 million. But if you look at that 760 million, and we only are paying for 30 because that's the appropriation that made it through the governor's veto, that means 730 carries forward. That would get added to the 445 of new demand, and we would have almost $1.2 billion worth of credit demand in FY18. Meanwhile, only $33 million would be appropriated in FY18 by the formula next year, when based on what we think the price of oil will be. And that means almost a little over $1.1 billion carries forward, and so on, until you get to 2025 and you're behind by about $2 billion on tax credits if we continue to fund at the statutory cap. So that's what this slide is intended to show.
Director Alpert, what this slide shows me is woulda, shoulda, coulda. FY18, the governor has created with his vetoes, a $600 million hole in our budget by not paying a bill that was owed.
I'm sure it's moving an obligation from 17 into 18 and onward. Yes, those are, on all accounts and all admissions, an obligation of the state. These are credits. There are not yet certificates in hand, but by the end of this month, the great bulk of them will be certificates in hand that the companies will be requesting payment on, and they'll be waiting until there's money available to make those payments.
Director Alpert, we're creating the problem, though. That's what I don't understand. You're advocating for a solution, but you're creating a problem for Alaskans, and then you're going out to the general public and telling the public we have a problem with something that this administration has created. And now, with this veto, almost 60%, over half of the problem, is all because the administration didn't pay a bill when it was supposed to. Something the legislature can go in and override, I get it, but why? I don't understand why we're not heavy on advocating for a fix versus not paying a bill that we actually owe.
I'm sure there's a couple of things here. We're trying to change the underlying programs so that not so much in tax credits are earned and owed in the future. And that's what the bill is for. The veto is about paying the past obligations that are not changeable. We can't make them go away by legislation or anything. This is an obligation. What's not required is to pay them now. There is no requirement of the state by them. There's no interest. There's no cost of delay. The governor, that veto was a very difficult decision for the governor. I could tell you that because a number of us were a part of that conversation. Is he going to do it? To what level is he going to do it? It was heartfelt, and it was difficult, and we know that it was going to put a strain on the industry and create a burden, a big number in FY18. As you know, the governor's original proposal last January was an appropriation to fund all the credits and wipe the slate clean on the past. But that was part of a comprehensive fiscal package. There were a bunch of bills that were going to solve our problems and balance our budget into the future. In the absence of that, suddenly the governor's larger concern is, how are we going to keep the lights on 2 and 3 years from now? You know, we were on a path to deplete the constitutional budget reserve a year from now. We have school obligations, we have health care obligations, transportation obligations, pension obligations, and just the day-to-day functioning of government, keeping the DMV offices open. You know, if we don't know that we're going to be able to do that, can we afford to fully fund this tax credit program when we can legally make a smaller installment payment on it and save some of that money for the future and hopefully resolve the underlying fiscal problems in the next year?
Senator Kelly.
Yeah, Ken, what you've done, it appears to me, is you've put together a slide that essentially cries out, help stop me before I make another irrational veto. Because as Senator McCann said, you created a problem, and now you're saying that somehow the problem that the governor created with the veto, that we have to, you know, make a complete fix or a complete change to our oil taxing regime rather than just have him start acting a little more savvy. He also said something in there that before he had the plan of paying off the tax credits with a larger fiscal plan, but as I recall, that assumed a use of the CDR, correct?
Through Chair Senator Kelly, yes, there was a CDR draw.
That was never, ever, ever going to happen. It was impossible, and I told the governor this early on in the session this year, and I think it was a little bit of a surprise that, guys, your CBR draw is impossible. It's not even in the realm of reality. So to say that, well, we have this plan to do this, but because that plan wasn't going to work, we had to do something else because there was not this larger fiscal plan that was ever enacted. The larger fiscal plan that you're talking about, it was like his vetoes. It was irrational. It didn't make sense. So this slide, it was like two things going on here, that the governor created the problem and now we have to change everything else instead of the governor's behavior. And the other thing is, oh, magically, you came up with the $2 billion number, which is an extremely political number. It's the number that's been thrown around for several years now as $2 billion giveaway. That was never true. And the people of Alaska voted for SB 21 because they realized what a sham that was. And now we are back here with another slide. You it's your business what you do, but a lot of work went into this. This is a very political slide as far as I can tell.
Madam Chairman?
Senator Bishop, I'll be to you next. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Opper, as you look at some of the issues that are going on and some of the ideas that public policy is at stake here, and we realize that the state of Alaska is in a bind, certainly, that's there, and we're trying to go ahead and make sure that we are not looked at negatively by raiders that are out there. But I wonder what the consideration was for those smaller companies, especially, because I come from the private sector, and, you know, I don't like my payments being late, and when they are late, it certainly puts a crunch on the businesses that are trying to go ahead and survive. And I'm not just talking about some of the exploration oil explorers or developers out there. I'm talking about the regular rank and file people that are dependent on those people that they contract with. What kind of consideration is being, because we know that, I guess my main concern is that the private sector people can go bankrupt and go out of business where you're affecting people's livelihood, the kids that are going to school, those kind of things. The state going bankrupt is kind of one of those obscure theoretical positions they can be in because they allow us to have some type of revenue coming on. What consideration is given to the private sector?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, thank you. And it's an important question to ask, and I know a lot of the players we're talking about do work in your district. The state has a lot of obligations. We're not just about the oil industry. We've got the rest of the government to run here. The anxiety over how we're going to do the rest of it as we see our reserves, our savings rapidly depleting, becomes the overarching factor. If we did this in full now, we might not be able to do something else tomorrow is really what it comes down to. We do need some level of comprehensive fix. There's no gamesmanship in that. I believe that to the bottom really hard. We need a comprehensive fix. If not this year, certainly next year. You know, that's the message the governor is trying to say. They put out the governor's office some paperwork today that shows more or less what would happen if we go off the cliff. I had to come up with a couple of bullet points over how my agency would function with 75% less funding. And I assure you, it's not pretty, and they're just the tax collector. Nobody likes the tax collector. The agencies would do a lot of work that people do like, but would also be living with 75% less funding. So we don't want to do damage to our private sector investors. We just, it's just about priority and making sure that we can keep the lights on a little bit longer.
Thank
you, Madam Chair. I like your analogy about the Zacchaeus, the ruler of the man type of thing, that being the tax collector. But I guess what assurances can you give the private sector or those people that are employed a second area out that, like you said, come from their district, that call me about their position that they find themselves in? And some, maybe like this pointed out, and I think we had this discussion before, where you would pay a minimal amount on the credit card versus the total amount that puts you into a little bit of a financial straits there. What can I tell them?
Thank you, Chair Olson, for mentioning that. Right, it's about making a minimum payment on a credit card rather than, and we've sort of been in the habit of paying our balance off every year, every month, for the past few years. I can't speak for the governor or guarantee or promise any future action. I believe that once he is satisfied that we have solved the problem to where we're out of the woods a little bit, where we know we can be functional, we've built the fiscal system that can sustain itself, he will want to set aside the funds to pay this debt down and get it off the books. There's no positive in having $1 billion lingering over our head. Just we need to get to the place where we know we have $1 billion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No further questions.
Senator Bishop, I'll be right to you. Director Alper, I find it interesting because we don't pay interest in reference to your credit card, and we can make the monthly payment or the minimum due. The issue that the Senate Finance is considering is the job loss by not paying our interest, bankruptcy of companies that we've already experienced, and then how that bankruptcy affects jobs as well as other people having similar losses and our credit downrating. I mean, the governor has been big about trying to maintain our credit worthiness, but as we see bankruptcy based on the non-payment of tax credits, I'm not sure that I could consider it a minimum payment when the interest is very different. The interest is job loss, downgraded credit, and other things. Do you have a response to that?
I'm sure I wish I had a pithy and easy answer for it. I mean, it's obviously a burden on the industry. It's not a place that we're comfortable being. It's not a place we want it to be. You're right. We don't, per our own rules, we don't have to pay interest to the companies per se, but they do have to pay interest to their financiers, and a lot of them have cash calls. And the great bulk of these credits are owed against borrowed money. These companies didn't have their own cash reserves to invest in their field. They borrowed it with the expectation of payment. We get it. We get it as well as anybody. We live this every day. It is an uncomfortable and unfortunate reality of our fiscal situation. And if I may, Madam Chair, Co-Chair Kelly said something a couple of minutes ago about a CBR draw to pay these wasn't going to work. But the reality is the budget that just passed is funded two-thirds out of the CBR. Whether it was general fund or a set-aside special CBR appropriation, if we put $600 billion in the tax credits, it would be coming out of the CBR, just directly or indirectly.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some of what I wanted to say, you and some others have already covered it, but on another point, I want to come back to the forecasted section of the, on page, what was it, 6 here on the NOL carry forward liabilities. With your permission, or whatever, I would like to see this 16 through 25 ran, these numbers ran, with the debt paid as it's encumbered in that year, then see what the bottom line looks like down here at the bottom, because as you get into the forecasted increase price in oil, I would like to see what that number looks like, because a lot, you know. Anyway, well, there's a jet coming over. I'm at my house. The air conditioning's broken in the office.
It is hot in the interior today.
So, I'd like to see that ran, because I, with all due respect to the administration, I think we're chasing the red herring here to a degree, because, you know, we're not Texas, we're not North Dakota, we're not Wyoming. It takes 10 years at best from the initial discovery to point of production to bring a field online. We don't bring fields online in 30 days, 60 days, or 6 months like any place else in the 48. These are long-term commitments. And, I'd just be rehashing what I've been saying for the last 5 months in general at the table on the same topic. But I would like to see these numbers ran with the debt paid in the year that they were encumbered, and then see what the bottom line looks like.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Director Alford, can you see those numbers run?
We will, through the chair, Senator Bishop, you know, that number that says end of year fund balance, that a little bit over $2 billion, will be a zero. Basically, we're going to stay abreast of our obligations every year in this scenario, and we're going to pay it. What that means is we're going to spend about $2 billion more, and that's $2 billion that are going to come out of reserves, assuming those numbers exist in reserves. What we're going to butt up against is the bottom of the CDR. Are we now getting into the earnings reserve? We're getting into, you know, fundamental questions of restructuring that, you know, frankly, your body, the Senate, passed a bill that goes a long way towards fixing that, and part of our struggle is that the rest of the legislature hasn't followed suit. But that number, $2 billion on this slide, is the real obligation for the next 6 or 7 years. What was interesting in building this slide, updating the slide from what I brought to the Finance Committee last month, is it used to be $3 billion. And the reason it's not $3 billion is because you did pass House Bill 247. There is something like $1 billion over the next 10 years in authentic savings on tax credits in that bill. We're going to be spending that much less, and therefore we have reduced the state's burden, and that is something that we should all, frankly, be proud of.
Director Opera, I appreciate that. I wish in some of the governor's press releases we would see that reference, because the general public believes that for some reason the legislature didn't act on anything in the governor's package, and in fact we did. I love we're going to save $1 billion over the next 10 years based on what the legislature passed, which was part of the fiscal plan, but that has not been in the press release. The governor has thanked the Senate on multiple occasions, which I greatly appreciate. Senator Kelly? No? Director Alger, please continue.
Madam Chair, so I'm going to go into what just passed, House Bill 247, a little bit for the next couple of slides. I'm on slide number 7.
Director Alger, could you pause for 1 minute? Sure. Senator Machicki, are you there?
I am, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that we had our communications crossed, so I appreciate you joining us and that you will be in and out of reception if we can't get back to you, but thank you for following the conversation, and if you have a question, please interject.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, how does the bill get passed? Now was signed by the governor the day he signed the budget. Affect regionally throughout the different oil producing provinces of the state. In Cook Inlet, it is by far its most aggressive components are in Cook Inlet, the complete phase out. These acronyms we all got familiar with over the last 6 months, the net operating loss, qualified capital expenditure, and well lease expenditure credits are all phased out by 2018. They're kept intact in 2016, cut roughly in half in 2017, and phased out in 18. It does, however, extend the so-called tax caps on gas indefinitely, and you'll see that shows up as a negative in the fiscal picture in some years in the revenue side, meaning that the tax caps that were going to go away in 2022 have been extended, but we've added a new tax on cooking with oil of $1 a barrel. That tax has historically been zero, so we're going to see a little bit of revenue, $5 million or so a year, from a new cooking with oil tax.
and then the pro-rationing of costs for municipal utilities that have a gas field and sell some of it to a third party and burn most of it themselves, a little cleanup language on that, of minor provision. In Middle Earth, we went about halfway where we did on Cook Inlet as far as reducing the operating loss and spending credits to about half their current level that they maintain at that lower level beyond 2017 into the future, and then the one-year extension of the Frontier Basin exploration credit targeted at the at high probability areas in places like Nana and Glen Allen. We believe that they can find oil and gas, and we're creating large credits for their first couple of wells. That was extended by 1 year. On the North Slope, the changes are limited to the gross value reduction. That the GVR, we call it the graduation, the sunset where new oil becomes old oil after 7 years, and if the price of oil is high enough, it could be as soon as 3 years after the beginning of production. And also a technical provision that you can't use a value reduction to increase the size of a net operating loss. There's something of a bug in the SB21 formula that led to some artificially high operating loss credits with certain producers. That's been rectified in the bill that passed. The statewide changes are also quite dramatic, and to the point where I have to put multiple ones on the same board. The $70 million per company per year cap, Madam Chair, this is a provision you're closely involved with in writing. You know that really means about $61 million because the second $35 million would only be purchased if desired by the company at a 25% discount. So that works out to about a $61 million effective per company per year cap. So there's a change in the interest rate calculation. We've got some concerns with that, but it gets a robust interest rate for 3 years and then drops it to zero. The transparency, meaning we will, beginning next year, be able to name names and say who's getting tax credits, how much they're getting. Some rank ordering of limited funds. If we don't have enough money, we get to prioritize the companies with the higher local or Alaska resident hire. That's important. The ability to use credits to offset obligations to the state other than taxes, royalties and the like, and also a surety bond for producers to help offset. If someone goes bankrupt and leaves some local vendors hanging, there's a little bit of a protection bond to cover those in that event. So that's the bulk. That's really all the changes in House Bill 247. There's a lot on this slide. That's more of a refresher. I'll pause and see if there's any questions.
Questions from committee members. Director Alford, how many of those provisions are in the new Bill 5005? I saw interest on page one that you're coming back after interest changes.
So we're coming after the interest changes, and the municipal pro-rata has a technical cleanup section. Those are the only pieces that are amended. We're looking at on the North Slope extending things that were done in Cook Inlet, but we're not changing any of the pieces that were already done in 247. So this is a snapshot of what amounts to the fiscal note of 247, and all of these bills have two halves to them. Are they raising revenue or changing revenue in some way, and are they changing spending? And by spending, what we're talking about is buying tax credits, the expected demand for about repurchasing credits. On the revenue side, in the near term, House Bill 247 increases us by about somewhere between zero and $25 million. I know it's silly to put in paper, but it's true. There's enough unknown in there that it could be zero, it could be as high as $25 million. But really what we're talking about is in Cook Inlet, certain of these credits that were cut are going to be refunded, would have been refunded, but some of those credits would have been used to offset taxes by some of the companies. If the credits are no longer there, but the companies continue to produce, they would therefore be paying those taxes. And that's where most of that money is going to come from. There's also the $5 to $10 million from the dollar a barrel oil tax. If round numbers with the amount of production you have in Cook Inlet minus the royalty times 365, it's about 5 million, 6 million taxable barrels per year currently produced in Cook Inlet. So dollar a barrel, and then there's a tax cut in there, meaning you start seeing negative revenue. And you know, I said there's $1 billion in savings and spending on the previous slide. That is somewhat offset by the tax cut in some of the out years, and that might have diluted the public perception of the impact of 247 because of the extension of the cooking with tax caps past 2022. Those were scheduled to come off the books, and the underlying 35% tax is going to kick in 2022.
by extending those into the future, it shows up as a negative in the fiscal, in the revenue estimates. The reality is, that's an overblown number. No one really expected that 35% tax to kick in 2022. It was, however, our statutory baseline, so it's what we had to model based on. There's intent to be incendiary there. It's just using numbers that were before us. So we've got the revenue we discussed in the first bullet, about $20 million additional revenue from the sunset of GVR, from the new oil fields graduating to become old oil fields, and then, you know, $75 to $150 million in tax cuts from the extension of the cooking oil tax cap, and that's the revenue side of the picture.
Jeff, Alper, could we pause for a moment and talk about why we would probably not increase taxes to 35% in the Cook Inlet?
Madam Chair, when PP2 was before the legislature in 2006, ELF had been in place for 20-plus years, and the ELF formulas were widely understood to be distorted, broken. It still got a lot of tax from Prudhoe Bay, and it still got a lot of tax from Alpine, which was a relatively new field at the time, so it hadn't sort of fallen down the slope of a formula that was tied to per-well productivity. But most of the other fields on the North Slope were paying a very low production tax, less than 1% of the gross, and in Cook Inlet, the taxes were zero, and the Cook Inlet gas taxes under ELF were quite low as well. While there was a desire to raise revenue from the North Slope through the PPT bill, it was an important reform package, and it was part of Governor Murkowski's Stranded Gas Act process. No one wanted to raise the tax on gas in Cook Inlet at that moment in history because there was a larger concern of gas supply and utility security, that there's going to be enough gas to keep the lights on in greater Anchorage in the future years. So what was built into that bill was carved out something of a hold harmless that said that taxes on oil and gas in Cook Inlet were not going to exceed what they were before this bill passed, meaning the ELF rates from 2005 in simple English. That was a 15 or 16 year hold harmless, so until 2022. So meanwhile, we're getting closer to that date. What ends up happening in 2022 is the underlying statutes come in. But the underlying statutes have never been built for Cook Inlet. So you're left with something of a hodgepodge of multiple other bills. You have the 35% SB 21 tax rate, but there's no per barrel credit or comparable benefit on the North Slope. You've got no new oil benefit. The 20% capital credits going away. So it would be a very large 35% net tax. Sometime between now and 2022, someone was going to have to come in and fix that. It was going to be a lower tax, but a more sustainable tax built for cooking it, oil and gas. HB 247 took an effort at that, but the effort it took by extending the tax caps, we contend, is probably too low. The 17-cent per MCF tax on gas in Cook Inlet is probably not the state's highest and best use of that resource, so we could probably get a little bit more. But the other end of that equation is $150 million more from a 35% net tax. The right answer is probably in the middle somewhere.
If I could, Director Alper, do you know where the oil is sold in the Cook Inlet region? Where does that oil predominantly go to as far as the buyer goes, do you know?
Sure, it goes to refineries in Cook Inlet. It's used here in Alaska.
So if I could try to put a fine point on this, the reason that at least, and it's not Anchorage, it's the Central Peninsula area. So the oil is bought so that Anchorage and the Central region understands, including Matsu, almost all of the product is sold to a in-state refinery, and Senator Michiki gave me this number, so if he can hear us, I believe that accounts for about 30% of the feedstock at the Tesoro refinery. Do you have a comment on that?
I'm sure I've heard similar numbers, but the refineries in Alaska are able to absorb all of the oil production from Cook Inlet and still are importing crude oil or buying their slope crude oil to fill their own capacity.
And so if there was an increase of 35%, how would the refinery collect that? How would they recover that?
Madam Chair, if there was a higher tax on Cook Inlet oil, it would be taxed more like North Slope oil. So that I think that would probably be something that would get
work through somehow. Really, we're talking about is cooking with gas, which is by far the bulk of the BTUs produced in cooking with the gas. And that's what's paying the 17-cent tax. Now, all of that gas is, of course, used locally or exported through when there are exports through the ConocoPhillips facility. But that, if there were a higher tax, no doubt it would affect the utility rates in South Central.
Thank you. That's where I was trying to get to. It would be ratepayers in Anchorage as well as the central region that would have to pay that tax. And so possibly from a political perspective, those folks that probably would be opposed to a 35% increase in taxes in the region are trying to protect the consumers on the other side. Is that possible?
Madam Chair, the only thing I would say to clarify that, it's not a 35% increase, it's a 35% net profits tax, which would be a very, very high tax in Cook Inlet. Without question, that would be a multiple increase, probably 5 or 6 times the current tax is what would be kicking in 2022 under the statute as it existed prior to the passage of 247.
Madam Chair?
Commissioner Hoffbeck.
Yes, to recommend you off that, Commissioner Redman. Just again to draw a distinction between how much of the gas, the tax on the gas would get passed to the consumers. I think that's relatively certain that a large majority of that would be passed to the consumers. The, as far as the oil, and its use in refined products, those prices are driven largely by the competition of what a delivered price from some other refiner might be. And so it would really depend upon whether the refiner was running at the refining margins were how great the refining margins were, whether they can absorb the tax or not. There's a good chance that the entire 35% tax rate would not be passed on to the consumers, since the price is largely set by other competitive product that can be delivered from other West Coast refiners.
Mr. Hoffbeck, I concur with that. About 30% of the feedstock going into the local refinery comes from Cook Inlet, so 70% is coming from another source. As I understand it, again, I'm depending on others that are in the market doing that, but those are broad numbers, so that number would go down. Cook Inlet gas is being sold right now at some of the highest prices in the world. So our consumers would be and will be the ones that are picking up some of these price changes that have been proposed.
Madam Chair, I concur with that.
Thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki.
Yes, and I concur with what Commissioner Hoffbeck said. I just, one consideration the Commissioner may not be making is the less competitive Alaska oil is that is produced by Alaska Jobs and an Alaskan facility, the more likely imports will compete. And I don't know that with this current job market any of us can afford throwing another tax in the way. So the whole discussion came about saying that a 35% tax on cooking that oil and gas is unreasonable. That is the case. I agree that's likely not going to occur. But the reason for holding off on an increase right now was certainly that so that we could take the time to evaluate what a proper tax should be without simply slipping into the 35% rate in a few years.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Well said.
Chair, if I didn't just say something there, and I just want to put it on the record, there is no proposed change to cooking with oil and gas tax in the legislation before you right now. Although we did have issue with the extension of those caps in the previous legislation, that's done. We weren't looking to change that until 2022 anyway, frankly. If the sunset was still in place, we would be passing a tax cut because we would be undoing something that's about to kick in 2022. Now, when we look to put in the right cooking the tax in the future, it's going to be sold as a tax increase, and that's going to be a little bit harder to get done. But that's the reality that's what we're faced with right now, and we're prepared to fight that fight in a future day.
Director Alpar, thank you. The only reason I ask the question is because when we get into that $775 million that is distorted by the $200 million veto that will be distorted further next year by the $430 million veto, when you interjected your comparison and rightly said that it probably would have never reached the 35%. some folks hang on to just a particular portion of a conversation, and there's a reason why that the legislature's chosen to walk cautiously into this conversation, and I appreciate you bringing it out. I just wanted to hover there for a moment so that the people in the central region understand that we were trying to take a look to who would in the end pay some of those increases. It's not the state that would pay the increases. It's the consumer at the end that will help inside of the market to cover some of those costs as we withdraw tax credits as well as increase taxes in that region.
This is a little bit of a distraction from the underlying bill. We're not really talking about curbing the taxes. I wanted to raise it. It's important. These are why you haven't got enough credit for 247 and the good that it did. If you were to look at the final fiscal note for that bill and just read across the bottom line number, it doesn't add up to $1 billion. It adds up to a much smaller number because that number is eroded by this paper tax cut on the Cook Inlet side. On the savings side, on the spending side, it does add up to $1 billion, and that's what you saw in that earlier slide. But on the revenue side, you start seeing negative numbers, and that's where they come from. So to get to where I was on the bottom, I believe I'm on slide 8, the spending reductions, that's where you see a total of about $1 billion in the next 8-10 years. You won't see the full impact of them until FY19. That's just the delay built into the bill and the slower ramping down of the cooking of the tax credits. But once we get there, the annual savings are in the neighborhood of $65 to $115 million a year. We're really talking about an overall reduction in what the state will be spending on tax credits, cash credits, or obligated to spend. We can't say what we're actually going to spend. We had that conversation too. But somewhere between a third and 40% is what we're cutting them by. So a dramatic reduction. And the largest portion of that is, of course, the Cook Inlet cuts, a smaller impact from the per company cap and the haircut or the 25%, what I guess we'd call it the discounts, or the fix to the GVR, gross value reduction, net operating loss interaction issue. It has about a $15 million savings in some years in it. So what wasn't passed, and that's part of why we're here, some provisions of 247, not all of these are in the bill before you, but to refresh on what we were talking about, we were looking to increase the minimum tax to 5%. The original proposal had that at all prices. We're not there now. We were looking to so-called harden the floor, prevent certain credits from being able to go below the minimum tax. We had the issue, which is sort of some fun modeling to explain, of how the per barrel credits earned in 1 month are used to offset taxes that might be obligated from another month, the migration of what's called the true-up issue. We had a proposal of gross value at the point of production. That's the wellhead value upon which royalty is taken, and also it's the starting point before other deductions to get to production tax. But that can't go below zero for a specific field. If you've got very high transportation costs combined with low prices, that's one phenomenon we were concerned about. We were looking to restrict repurchases outright for companies with more than $10 billion in global revenue, and also sunset operating losses after 10 years. That was the original proposal. And then our interest rate increase, which was meant to be universal, was limited to just 3 years and then reduced to a rate that's below our current rate, actually to zero after the 3 years is what was in 247. There were other provisions that were not in our bill, but were in the bill that passed the House, the other body. In addition to what we proposed that came to the Senate and did not make it to the end, the cash payment currently is, under current law, says that you have to have less than 50,000 barrels a day to be eligible for cash. The House bill reduced it to 15,000 barrels a day. As your question, Madam Chair, earlier alluded to, the House ramped down the NRL credit rate from 35 to 25% over several years, and then it restricted them outright, basically created the zero tax structure like we're proposing for companies more than 15,000 barrels a day. They wouldn't earn NRLs at all. Below the 15,000 is when they would be earning the 25% rate. They went in the other direction on the cooking with tax caps, doing an early sunset. So they would have gone away in 2019. That showed up as a big artificial tax increase, much the way the Senate bill showed up as a big artificial tax cut. And they also created an alternative purchase option for unbought credits if the state doesn't have money, empowering the ARM board, the retirement management board, to buy those credits at a discount and then be able to gain the benefits from it at the face value, kind of a backdoor way
of providing indirect support for the state's pension obligations was a new solution that the House came up with. So the next few slides, Madam Chair, are going through the actual legislation you have before you, Senate Bill 5005. This is bill number one on this slide, just to forewarn you, it goes to eight, but only the first three or four of them are what one might call big. But the big one, the biggest of all, is a complete phase out of the North Slope net operating loss credit. This is similar to what was done in Cook Inlet. This is something of a maximalist position. With 35% today, would become 15% next year and zero in 2018. It sets a tax rate that you cannot go below zero. You cannot carry forward losses for companies that are not profitable. Commissioner Hoffbeck really spoke to the next two bullets already. Very different in how it impacts two different types of companies. The major producers, it means that they can't carry their losses forward. If they lose money one year, they're still paying their minimum tax the next year. The net effect is, without officially hardening the floor, we're indirectly hardening the floor. We're going to force minimum tax payments because there's no ability to offset it against these operating loss credits. In some ways, an even more dramatic impact on the independents because they're the ones who are getting cash credit on their ongoing expenditures and getting partially reimbursed while they're in the development phase. That would cease, and they would instead simply be making investment, just like happened 30 and 40 years ago when Alaska oil patch was developed the first time, and they would expect to make their money by selling the oil after they were done. So that is, this is new language. It is a more aggressive stance towards operating losses than was seen in any of the prior versions of the legislation this session.
Senator Dunleavy.
Yeah, Chair, dealing with number one, does price impact the NOLs, or is there a certain price where those NOLs become a non-issue, disappear, et cetera?
Well, Chair Senator Dunleavy, half yes, half no. For the independents who are developing a field that don't have any revenue, price doesn't matter because they don't have any revenue. Their NOL is 35% of their costs, whatever their costs might be. For the major producers, it's only relevant if they have a loss. Although it varies dramatically from company to company, the weighted average and break-even price on the North Slope today is about $45 a barrel. So if the price of oil is demonstrably higher than $45, we don't expect to see a lot of NOLs from the majors, and this provision would be moot. It would not have any material impact on it.
We're close to that price right now, aren't we?
Yesterday we were about 44, and we've been as high as, we just barely touched 50 a couple of weeks ago, but it didn't last for long.
Just one last question. You said something about they would have to invest or deal with the oil patch as we did 35 years ago.
Through Chair Senator Dunleavy, in other words, when Prudhoe Bay and Park and the big fields that are bread and butter were built, there were no tax credits. There were no carried forward operating losses. It was a gross tax, and there were no incentives for development. They were just building an oil field.
And using that, has the technology that's unleashed oil in the lower 48 and in other parts of the world, fracking, does that alter that concept? In other words, 35 years ago, we weren't unleashing oil in North Dakota. You had majors, you had traditional drilling, as they would say, or traditional exploration, traditional development, traditional production. We have a new game interjected into the larger, or a new player interjected into the larger game, which is fracking. So will that have an impact at all on on that concept of behaving like it did 35 years ago?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, this is not my area of expertise, but the increase in technology, precise directional drilling, hydraulic fracturing, and the like, have made available pools that might not have been developable 30 years ago simply because they couldn't be precisely targeted. I think there's a lot more oil available that might not have been. I would say the biggest difference between now and then is scale. When you're building a 15 or 20 billion barrel field, there's big economies to scale and you can mobilize a lot of capital. A lot of what's in the North Slope is smaller, with the new stuff anyway, or any smaller fields that are going to have a little bit higher per barrel cost. And I think that's where some of the desire, some of the push to provide incentives came from, the higher cost and the logistical struggles for
for the new operators that were coming up here.
Hey, just a comment, I'll be done. The world is vastly different than it was 35 years ago across the board, from cell phones to all types of science and advances and technology and so on. I don't know if I would be saying that they can behave like they did 35 years ago. It's a different world.
Yeah.
Without
question.
Senator Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Alper, if Ms. Rogers here will let me get a word in edgewise. on that 35 year ago issue too. Is it fair to say also that the regulatory environment has taken up so much of what companies spend to develop a field? Because I've heard that before about we should have, we develop the fields with no credits. And I think Senator Dunleavy was talking about a number of technological changes that have happened, but as well to develop a field up there. Holy cow, the regulatory environment seems almost impossible for them to do it profitably, and yet somehow they do. Anyway, my point is that also something that maybe we should put into the math as we're looking at how business was done 35 years ago?
Through the chair, Senator Kelly. Probably, but that's not the Department of Revenue. We're not permitting that way, but I'm sure someone else, I believe Senator Bishop's question earlier, when he started talking about 7 to 10 years to get an oil field in place, not all of that's logistics, a lot of that's permitting. You need to go through there, and that's anywhere, but air quality and water quality and all of those things, and a limited drilling season. I think we are a little tighter in handling some of the unique environmental issues on the North Slope. I think the fact that the frozen season being a little shorter makes it harder for them to operate. I know Senator Olson could speak to that a lot better than I could, but the ability to build ice roads is different. Yes, it is not easy to develop an oil field in the North Slope of Alaska, no question about it.
Senator Kelly?
Do you happen to know, and maybe this is a question for the DNR, Commissioner, but do you happen to know how long it used to take us to bring a field online? We talk now in terms of 10 years, and I think Senator Bishop was talking earlier about some of the places in the lower 48 where they can, 30 to 60 days they can bring a field online, and it's a completely different environment. Not only environment in the actual environment, but it's a different regulatory environment, it's a different constitution they're working under. So I understand that those differences are going to exist. My question was, do you know what it used to take, like in 1979 or 1980 or something like that? Have we always dealt with 10 years?
Through the chair, Senator Kelly, in 1930 it was like nothing. But once the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act passed, there was a relatively robust process, and our oil field, Prudhoe Bay, was built after that environment. You may recall that it took longer than the companies expected. They shipped a lot of pipe up here, and it sat in piles along the haul road for 4 or 5 years waiting to get federal permits to build pipes. That was a little bit stunning. So the delay is not brand new to our generation.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Hoffbeck.
Commissioner Rebo. If my memory serves me correctly, the last major field that was developed on the North Slope was Alpine, and I think it did take close to 10 years to develop.
85,
ConocoPhillips? CD5 is not to quite the extent that the Alpine field was. I mean, Alpine was brand new out in the Caldwell Delta with no infrastructure around it, and it was close to 10 years. I think CD5 has a bridge issue that held it up for a long time. I'm not exactly sure what the total years was on that.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions from online, Senator Machicki or Senator Bishop?
No, ma'am. No, I'm fine. I'm just listening. Good conversation.
Thank you, gentlemen. Director Alper, please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I believe we beat up slide 11 as best we can. I'm going to move to slide 12, which has the next couple of features. We are reducing the eligibility for cash credits from $50,000 to $15,000. I mentioned a few minutes ago that was in the House version of the bill, but really because of the changes made in number one, that change is a relatively limited impact. In 2017, it would make a difference where there's still the 15% NOL. And the operating loss credit, by eliminating it on the North Slope, really this becomes a Middle Earth credit, the operating loss. So we would be restricting the Middle Earth operating loss credit to just producers of less than 15,000, and right now there is no production at all from the interior. So item number two is a relatively limited application. It sort of comes along for the ride with item number one. Item number three is a bigger deal. That's the minimum tax increase. This is a milder version of what we proposed 6 months ago, because it doesn't kick in to that 5% level until the price of oil hits $55 a barrel. Now, the way the 4% tax works now, if you read the fine print of the statute, it's not really a 4% tax. It's already something of a stair step, but those stair steps were written long ago so that the stairs are in almost unrealistic numbers. The price would have to be below $25 for a full year to get down to 3%, below $20 to get to 2%, and so on. So right now, so long as the price is about $25 a barrel, we're at 4%. This would make a fifth step at 5% for prices above $55 a barrel, meaning between about 4% would be between 25 and 55. And then the so-called crossover, where the revenue line kicks from the minimum tax out to the SB 21 net profits tax with the per barrel credit, happens somewhere between $75 and $80 a barrel. So that's why when I said a little while ago, this would be a tax increase between $55 and $80 a barrel. This is something of a hybrid. The original bill, once again, at 5% of all prices. The House had the 5% kick in at $65 a barrel. So we're somewhere in between those two positions with our $55 step.
Senator Kelly.
Yeah, Director Alper, I'm just trying to follow that. So you have 4% rate is, so it's at 25%, that's what we have now, but it would be a mandatory 4% between 25 and 55, correct? Regardless of your losses. And then at between 50 or 75 and 80, we essentially go back to the current regime, tax regime.
So yeah. Future Senator Kelly, right now it's 4% between 25 and around 75 or 80. So this says it'd be 4% from 25 to 55 and then 5% from 55 to the crossover point.
Oh, and it, 75 to 80 barrels, it just goes back to the current regime.
There's the break-even point in the calculation, Madam Chair, where the 35% of the net minus the, at that price point, it's $8 a barrel, the per barrel credit, is exactly equal to 4% of the gross. That's the crossover point. And it's roughly between $75 and $80 a barrel. And as you raise the minimum tax, it actually pushes the crossover point to the right a couple of dollars. So it's going to go from 76 to 78, something like that, if we do the increase to the 5%.
Thanks.
Other questions? Director Alper, I have one. If this is our walkthrough of the actual sectional analysis, then on the minimum tax, once it hits 55, does it trigger and we step over the hurdle and it stays there forever, or does it trigger and go back and forth based on this 4% in the language that we have before us?
Madam Chair, this is a place where I'm going to say half an answer and actually defer to my audit master next to me, but the minimum tax is based on the average price for a calendar year. And so we get these estimated tax payments, and then there's the true-up at the end of the year. So every year is a separate calculation, and I'm going to shut up and let Jenny talk.
Madam Chair, I think that you're right. The annual tax is one calculation, but the monthly installment payment, it may go back and forth in and out on that calculation.
Thank you, Ms. Rogers. Dr. Alper, we're going to need some clarification, if you could, on specifically what the language in the bill does regarding to how that moves. Certainly the people who want to pay that, well, the people who would be required to pay this tax are going to want some specificity on how it works. And so for me, once we move over a 55 price per barrel for a year, does that fix then inside of state statute so that people can start streamlining their processes, or is it a variable that drops back and then we have to wait for a following year so that each year we're going to change the tax calculation? I think that would be one question that we would have. Anyway, if we could get a little bit more.
Yes, but we will get something right in, Madam Chair, but the long and the short of it is one minimum tax rate for a year at the annual true-up, and that number should be able to be a different number 1 year than another. If by some miracle the price of oil was only $22 a barrel this year, the minimum tax would be 3%, but that doesn't prevent it from going up to 4% next year.
Thank you.
The issue number four somewhat confuses what we were just talking about, the issue of the interaction of the per barrel credit, which is a monthly credit, which actually does change value from month to month. The sliding scale can be $5 one month, $8 the next, and $2 the month after that, because it's tied to that month's price of oil. What happens with the per barrel credit, though, is in a year where there's a lot of volatility, and the target example is 2014, if you have certain months of the year where the tax calculation was above the minimum tax, was in the SB 21 calculation, certain months where it was below, what happens in the below months, which were the later months of 2014, you got to the 35% of the net, you started subtracting the $8 a barrel, and you couldn't use the whole $8 because you bumped up against the 4% of the gross calculation. Now, the per barrel credit is designed to not be transferable or carry forwardable. It's a use it or lose it credit. So those credits were lost in the low price months. But in other months, they used the full per barrel credit and they paid a net profit tax. At annual true up, companies were able to recapture the unused per barrel credits from those low price months, effectively offsetting tax obligations from the higher price months. In real terms, and we paid about $110 million in refund checks after the 2014 tax true-ups, and fix number four here would prevent that from happening. It would turn the per-barrel credit into a true monthly tax calculation. It's not an overall monthly tax the way ACES was. It is a very limited application of a monthly tax for this one specific issue, and it would only kick in a year with a lot of volatility. And this was in the governor's original bill, and it was also in the version of House Bill 247 that passed the House. The gross value at the point of production can't go below zero. This is about, which really can get into negative taxation. If there's a high transportation cost and a very low price, so you can get a negative wellhead value. The example we used in some of the more detailed testimony on 247 is Point Thompson. Point Thompson filed tariff just to get back to the pre-existing infrastructure was about $19 a barrel. So by the time you get from Point Thompson to Badami to Pump Station 1 and all the way to the market, they had about a $31 tariff. If the price of oil was 30, they would have a negative wellhead value of $1 a barrel, which would therefore be able to be offset against the wellhead value from other fields and create an impact on some of the other taxes the state would have collected. The fix number five would simply say, for a given field, you can't go below zero. It's rare that it would kick in. It would take a remote field and an extended period of low prices. Another plausible example we kicked around was Caris' Smith Bay prospect, which is very about 60 miles from existing infrastructure. It's going to be a very expensive transportation system. And if they face high transportation costs and low prices, they might have a negative wellhead value. And this was in the House version as well as the governor's original version of 247. Number six is the interest rate piece. We talked about this a little bit earlier. The law that passed as part of Senate Bill 21 was a 3% above the federal discount rate, simple interest. And I made the case, I hope convincingly, that the simple interest was an error. It was an amendment error in the late stages of Senate Bill 21 back when the bill was in House Finance, because all prior versions had compound interest. So issue one, we wanted to fix compound interest. Issue two, we thought the 3% rate was too low. The previous rate, the ACES rate, was 11%. So we were looking for 7%. What came out of the legislature was 7% plus Fed compounding, but only for 3 years and then reverting to zero. We want to go to the language that was in the House version, which is lower in the beginning, 5% plus Fed compounding, and then after a period of years, to account for the fact that there's legitimate concern that it takes us 6 years to audit sometimes, and sometimes that people are paying compound interest for an extended period of time, revert to simple interest after 4 years. That was what the House's solution to this same problem was. It's not just the issue of the 7 versus the 5 or the compounding or not. We have real concerns of what the impact of a zero interest rate is. It's not about years 4, 5, and 6. I think I said this to your committee when you were in June. It's about years 7, 8, and 9. What happens when there's an assessment? What if we say, you owe us taxes, we audit you. And they say, well, we're going to fight that. We're going to fight it to administrative hearings and the courts because there's no disincentive to. There's no accrued interest forever for as long as they continue to fight an assessment if there's literally zero interest rate. So the zero just seems a little bit unsustainable for us. And then the other technical issue that we might be able to resolve regulatorily is, what about the people that are in that window right now? This, you know, someone's been paying 3 years of interest at the 3%, and then the effective date of this new bill kicks in, and the zero rate was designed to compensate for the fact that you got relatively high interest rates for the first 2 years. What about when they got the current low interest rate for 3 years? Do they also get to go to zero? That's a little bit unclear in the wording of the previous bill, and there's not really transitional language that covers it. So we would like some clarification. We're going to try to resolve it through regulations, but we would like to honestly clean up the interest rate language if we're going to move any sort of tax bill this session. And the other change here is all different versions of the interest rate language as it's evolved through the previous years has applied to all taxes equally. There's never been a separate interest rate by a specific tax type. Whether it's oil and gas, alcoholic beverages, and everything in between, the HB 247 carved out this new regime for just the oil and gas production tax and left the old taxes, interest rates in place for all other taxes. And that's going to create some programming complexity and just some unnecessary bifurcation for us. We'd like to have a consistent interest rate regime across all of our taxes.
Questions from committee members? Director Alper, we've been down this particular road before, so you're certainly welcome to try to make your case. You continue to refer to what the House did. There were 3 members that stepped forward to send the ball down the field to the Senate, so I'm not sure that you can take everything that was in the House version and think that it's going to be acceptable to a group. We had a very difficult time removing, as you said, over 10 years, $1 billion worth of tax credits, and so we'll listen very carefully. We certainly don't want our auditors or our team that are trying to audit having more complex procedures. But we've done battle on some of these issues that are in this bill, and because the House passed it, isn't something that the Senate really takes into account. We certainly respect what they do, and we go through it as they present it to us, and then we usually do what the Senate believes is the right thing to do, you know, in a compromised position. So I appreciate the details, and we hope that you'll give us some specific bullet points for the challenge for the auditors to defend that assertion even in greater detail so that we get more specific. So if you could outline that proposal, this seems like soil that we've already tread through before, so
I appreciate that, Madam Chair, and there's no magic or gospel to what the House did. We would like a more enforceable and rational structure for all of our, for interest rate, and there's just some technical concerns with the Senate language that give us some anxiety. And look, we'll adapt to whatever the law is. This is the law right now, and if nothing passes, we will find a way to make it work. But I just want to put on the record, while we have the opportunity, while we're in the subject area, that this is one of the issues that gives us some concern.
Thank you, and I would like to highlight that you did say that you may try to solve this through a regulatory process if we don't take it up statutorily, so just put that on record for those that are following this conversation. Senator Kelly.
I had a question.
Senator Dunleavy.
Just clarification for the chair. If this bill does not pass, you're going to accept the law as it is and implement it? Is that what I heard you say?
Chair, Senator Dunleavy, yes, of course. The only gray area that the regulations will give some clarity as to how we enforce different pieces of it, and the part that we could address regulatorily was how exactly the effective date applies to existing debts and of a certain age and how things kick in. We just need to clean up the language for a transition period, but the law is the law, and we will, of course, enforce it.
And the other thing I was just trying to figure out is if this bill is not adopted, passed,
that's it. There'll be no other attempts at changing 21. This is it. It either does it this time or it doesn't. You know what you're saying?
Chair, so maybe, I'm not in a position to make that promise. I'm one way or the other.
Just trying
to
clarify. Thank you.
Madam Chair, we're moving to slide 15, which are the last two of the features. The municipal entity, we plowed this ground and we got the result that we wanted, only to find that it didn't quite work the way we wanted to. This is the circumstance where if you have a municipally owned utility that owns a gas field and they consume all of their own gas in their own turbines, it is not taxable easy, and their expenses don't get credits easy. I'm going to pause for Ms. Rogers in a second. I just want to finish the sentence. If they sell some of their gas, they have a small amount of revenue, they become a taxpayer. We cleaned up the circumstance, or tried to, that they would be able to get credits on all of their spending. We want only for them to get credits on the pro rata share of their spending that relates to the portion of their gas that they sell. But I think Ms. Rogers wants to finish my thought.
Through the chair. I think I just wanted to make the detailed note that all of what they produce is taxable, but because they're a municipal entity, it may not be taxed. So the portion that they sell is subject to tax. The other portion that they produce and don't sell is still taxable, but because they're a municipal entity, it is not taxed. It doesn't bear the tax. So we're aligning the expenditures with that portion that they produced and sold.
Director Alper.
Madam Chair, that's why it's a technical issue. It's not so much that the oil or the gas is taxable, it's that the taxpayer is exempt. The intent of what we tried to do, the language stayed the same throughout the process, and it wasn't until the very end that we realized there might be a definitional question relating to what Ms. Rogers was trying to say, that the taxpayer themselves is untaxable. So by saying that what's eligible for the credit, you just have to word it properly. So it's just I wish I had better language to explain this one, but it's and this is one that we should be able to fix through the regulatory process, because it's everyone's 100% agreement as to what the record was when it was passed. It just comes down to the technical idea that a municipal entity are themselves not taxable. We're not trying to make them pay taxes. We're just trying to restrict their ability to receive certain refundable credits.
Director Alper, that was certainly was my understanding. Did the legislature change the language? Because I thought we kept the original administrative language in trying to help you with this.
Yes, no, Chair, you and every other committee kept our language. This one was not amended one comma throughout the process. We just realized very late in the game that we probably wrote it wrong, and it was just really too late to get the changes to get into the bill before the end of the previous session.
Thank you.
And finally, number 8, there's the issue of data becoming public, you know, seismic and geophysical data. When there is a, right now, if a company owns a credit, obtaining certain data, it becomes public in 10 years. What the governor's bill is saying is, well, if they give up the lease in less than 10 years, maybe that data should become public immediately upon giving up the lease, and that way we can use that data publicly to try to re-lease the land and get a new customer, to get a new developer up there. So that's just a change to the 10-year. It's 10 years or when the lease is relinquished, whenever comes first.
Director Alper, and on number 8, on slide 15, is that a willingly give up the lease or litigated give up the lease?
Madam Chair, I'm not certain. I could look for the bill right now, but I think I'd rather get back to you with it.
If you could, because it seems like the Prudhoe Bay unit were entering into some territory that I haven't seen before. So if this is a willingly that the entity that purchased the lease wants to walk away from it in good faith, we just want to, gentlemen, understand if we win in a lawsuit, are we going to provide that data then to the general public?
Not to be flipped, but that'd probably take 10 years, too.
Yeah.
Director Alperin said, I have to say, you're probably right that it would take 10 years, but we still would like to know what the language does.
Absolutely. I mean, we'll get that clarified. And this this impacts DNR a little bit more than us, and we'll consult with them and get a coherent answer back to your committee shortly.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the next slide, number 16, is about implementation costs. Although these changes will take some additional programming for the tax revenue management system, they would be layered along with some changes that we're already making based on the bill that had passed. The previous bill contained $1.2 million that was in the capital budget. Senate Bill 138, I believe, was its number. If passed, it is law. We have access to that $1.2 million, so we are not asking for any additional money with this bill. We'll use what we already have and make any needed changes. Likewise, we won't take any more money to administer the program. Our existing staff levels are just fine for the production tax and tax credit system. We are, in fact, and you should see it in the paper soon, it's going to be a big process. We have a major regulatory revision process cycle that we are to implement House Bill 247. It's been a while since we've readdressed the oil and gas regulations, so it's time anyway, and now we've got an incentive to do so. And a good chunk of our interim will be spent on these regulations, presuming, Madam Chair, that we have an interim.
Director Alper, the legislature is waiting for that, too.
And there is a proper sectional beginning on slide 17, just to put the sequence of the bill. So if members want to read it, then look at this side by side to see what the sections do. I'm rehashing some ground that I've already talked through here. But section 1 is the interest rate. That's in 4305. In other words, the general production the general tax statutes that apply to all taxes, as opposed to 4355, which is the oil and gas production tax. So it tends to show up first for the changes to the interest rate, as described. Section 2 is the floor, the minimum tax, adding that new language about the $55.
Madam Chair. Director Alper, could we pause for just a moment? Brief at ease. We're back on the record. Director Alper, we have a sectional. If you could send us this in a Word document form so that we can make it, if this is available inside of a PowerPoint, we'd like to label the PDF file so that the public can access it directly. So if you could send that in a Word document, or do we have it in a Word document? If you could send it in a Word document, that would be helpful.
The sectional as a separate document. We use this format starting with January, and because we did, and committees have generally wanted a separate document, and we will provide you on.
Thank you. It just it makes it more concise for the general public to pull the documents offline.
Sure. The documents that were presented to the committee, you have a fiscal note, you have this presentation, of course. There's one other document I want to draw your attention to, which is just a one-page analysis of the expected future spend for credits as modified by HB 247. That one, thank you for the visual aid. The table on page 2 of that document is just shows the impact of the bill and how it's going to reduce our expected spending on tax credits for the next 10 years. So,
thank you, Director Alper. If I could, that is available and online for the public. It's titled Estimated Tax Credit Payments with Impacts of FY17 budget and HB 247 in the millions. It's prepared by Dan Stickle, the chief economist, and it has his phone number. The document's dated 7/12/2016, and it's 2 pages. On the second page is a graph that you can look at. So if the public's trying to follow that, Director Alper, I didn't mean to interrupt, just wanted to make sure the public could find the document.
Thank you. And when I said earlier that a third to a 40% of the credits are reduced by HB 247, you could see that math on page 2 of the document you were just talking about.
Thank you, Director Hopper. Are there any questions for the Director or Ms. Rogers or Commissioner Hoffbeck? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if he was going to go over the fiscal note, but my primary question on the fiscal note is beyond FY 2022, are the numbers going to continue to decline, or is there what do you envision for the next 5 years to 2027 on the changes of this particular piece of legislation?
For those that are following online, there is a fiscal note attached to SB 5005. It's called fiscal note number one. It's dated 7/11/2016. It has fiscal from FY 2017 through FY 2022. Director Alper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the fiscal note is a four-page document. The narrative goes through a lot of the same material I've covered, the description of the different provisions of the bill, the guts of it, and what I believe Senator Hoffman is referring to is the back page, which is a horizontal formatted table showing years and line item description of the different provisions of the bill. And to answer his question going forward past 2025, there's really two halves to it. The half that reduces our spending on credits is about stable. We use the number, the new revised number in a post 247 level, about $150 million per year on tax credits. That would almost be almost completely eliminated, and that would be spending coming off the long-term spending forecast. On the revenue side, you're seeing these positive numbers that come from the minimum tax increase largely in those years, 2022, 3, 4, 5. Once the price of oil, presumably and hopefully the price of oil, kicks over that $75, $80 number, you won't see the additional revenue anymore. So that won't be part of the picture.
Senator Hoffman, thank you. Director Alper, I think it's important to make sure the people of Alaska know that for the first time in the last decade that we have a increase in oil production. Is that accurate, and is that 3.3% that am I recalling that number correctly?
Madam Chair, that's correct. What we're talking about is the rough equivalent of about 15,000 barrels per day of production more last year than the year before.
Thank you. And then based on the spring forecast, which is footnoted on the reference to the fiscal note as well as the other actual that you provided us, are we above or below that price point at this time for what the spring forecast is indicating in these numbers? So the spring forecast lowered when we modified it. We lowered the price per barrel that we were anticipating. Is that price lower or higher than we're currently experiencing?
Madam Chair, the spring forecast had a FY17 price of $39 and change. Right now we're in the $43-$44 range, so should that price hold, we'll be about $4 above the estimate, which round numbers at these prices, a dollar in the price of oil, makes the state about $30 million a year.
So, Director Alford, we're overestimating then expenses right now and underestimating revenue on what's before us.
We are
slightly based on the...
We are underestimating revenue based on the price of oil. The volume of oil won't make that material a difference. A lot of the new and incremental production that led to this increase is in NPRA in areas that don't pay a high royalty to the state. And at low prices, the so-called new oil, gross value reduction eligible oil, doesn't really pay a production tax at very low prices.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Senator Dunleavy.
Common question, but the transportation costs help us. I mean, the transportation of that oil will help us stabilize by lowering the cost overall in the pipeline.
Interesting. That's correct. But we're more or less diluting the annual operating cost of caps by every extra barrel and reducing the cost on every barrel in doing so.
And just a question. To the best of your knowledge, is this all of the changes to SB 21 that the administration will be proposing, to the best of your knowledge?
Chair, Senator Dunleavy, all I can speak to is the bill that's before us. I do not know what might be proposed at a future time.
So there could be more proposals to 21?
Madam Chair, it's not mine to say. Perhaps the commissioner could say something. The governor's not here. My job is to help explain the governor's proposals. I don't know what the next proposal might be.
Commissioner Hoffbeck, are you there?
I am, Madam Chair, to recommend you have Commissioner Levin. I think it's uncertain what happens next. I mean, the governor did say when he came into office that rewriting SB 21 was not his agenda. But we certainly have found some areas where we thought we needed to fine tune it. I think until the entire fiscal package is put together, it's hard to be able to make a commitment that there would be no other changes. But it certainly is not. There's nothing in the planning right now that I'm aware of.
Commissioner Hoppeck, this is Senator McKinnon. Could you tell me, are there other tax credits that we're suspending?
Madam Chair, of course we did eliminate the film tax credit last year. That was a pretty large tax credit program. As far as some of the smaller credit programs, Director Alpert may have more knowledge than I do on those.
Madam Chair, the programs themselves aren't being suspended. So what we are, through the veto, we are suspending the purchase of tax credits. A lot of different credits fall under that umbrella, besides even the ones that we spoke about, the refinery credit, for example. Should there be any applicants that come in for refundable refinery credits, they're also going to be not paid. If there are education tax credits that are refundable, which I'm not even sure if there are, no, Ms. Rogers is shaking her head. So only the refundable tax credits are suspended. We only refund credits in the world of oil and gas. So it's a little bit of a circular question.
Director Alpert, we have an indirect expense report that outlines millions, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of additional dollars that are going to other industries. And so I was wondering if we were going to see a bill inside of this legislative session to suspend those tax credits or delay implementation of paying those tax credits.
Madam Chair, these are all credits that are used to reduce tax payments.
Yes, I'm aware.
Likewise, the production tax credits, including these NOLs, no one is or is trying to prevent anyone from using them to reduce their taxes. If someone earns them and has a tax obligation, they can reduce it, and we are not trying to suspend or impact that in some way. So I don't imagine trying to do that on the indirect expenditures. There has been legislation. One of the co-chairs of House Finance had a bill that eliminated some of those credits or programs or tax offsets or whatever you might call them. I would like, my personally like to see a more aggressive look into some of these things. I think there's lots of, I have a friend who's a legislative aide in the House that likes to call it finding change in the couch cushions, but that change tends to add up into the millions of dollars.
Senator Donnelly.
Careful. You just gave an opinion on where you'd like to go. I'm trying not to help you. That's all I'm doing.
I have opinions.
Director Alpert, my point in raising the issue is not tongue-in-cheek. There are industries that contribute across the state, and that all of those industries are being hit when the oil and gas industry is hit based on either the jobs that are created based on this industry, the money that's coming into the state of Alaska in the form of revenue, and that money is actually paying for not receiving taxes from these other industries. And so I do not mean it tongue-in-cheek. I am actually signaling that is there any look from this administration at delaying, holding off, paying all of the other industries that are contributing to Alaska's economy but are certainly paying less in the form of taxes to the government in doing so. And so I would appreciate an evaluation, because right now one industry is being held in front of the entire state as a reason to argue about their business practices, while other industries are benefiting significantly from the revenue that particular industry has been contributing to Alaska over the last 30, 35 years. And that's not meant to say that we shouldn't look at this. It's just that we're in this state together. We're all people of Alaska, and everyone is trying to help right this fiscal situation that we're in. So I'm just wondering if we can't suspend those other credits or delay paying those other credits against their tax liability, so that the state sees more revenue coming in versus
a deferral of the revenue by allowing other deductions.
Madam Chair, that is absolutely worth investigating, and we, I want to kick that around. I want to talk to our Assistant Attorney General and see what we can do. I know we do have a credit reduction built into the mining tax component. There was an omnibus smaller tax bill. I'm not sure if it's in your committee, honestly. No, it's not. It's in the Labor and Commerce Committee.
The only bill we have.
The only bill you have. Thank you for hearing it. I should have started with that, Madam Chair. This is our first presentation on any bill of this current special session, and I want to express my gratitude, the administration's gratitude for hearing our bill and giving us a chance to start making our case. There's a big package out there, and we are looking for other industries to contribute more. We've got a mining bill, a fisheries bill, a motor fuel, or alcohol and tobacco tax bill. The intent is still to pass all of them, as well as the essential permanent fund restructuring that the Senate passed last month, and get out of these woods and start moving towards building Alaska instead of fighting over how to fix Alaska, to paraphrase the governor.
Thank you. Other questions? I would like to apologize to the committee. We did not receive the governor's tax bill until Monday, and Monday late afternoon for me to actually first look at it. And so we did reach out to our contractors prior to coming into special session to see if they would be ready to analyze the bill from a fiscal perspective. Our contractor is not available. With that information, as Director Alker pointed out, we had to change contractors. One of our contractors left May, I think it was sometime in the May period, and so we actively pursued another contractor to do the fiscals. That person is not available at least until Monday. We reached out to the industry so that they would have a chance to review. They are not available till after Monday. So at this time, I have nothing else to come before the committee that we were able to prepare for the committee between now and Monday. So I just wanted to put that on the record, unless there is more from the administration that you would like to hear from on the Thursday or Friday. So if you would, if you don't feel comfortable today or you think about that, we are under the 24-hour rule, so if you think of something that we could ask the administration so that they can be better prepared for as we move into next week, that would be helpful. But again, we did reach out and did everything in our power to be able to provide meetings for the rest of this week, but the analyst was not ready. And again, in defense of the analyst, they are trying to restructure history and their knowledge of what has happened in Alaska's tax structure. So they want to be well prepared so that they can enter into these very specific regions of the tax code and understand them and be able to give us the correct information. Ms. Kramer, did I adequately describe the situation? Thank you. Senator Bishop, Senator Machicki, any closing comments?
No, ma'am. No, ma'am, just soaking it all in. Good conversation, lots of good points for us to process in the future as well. So thank you.
Thank you. So we will continue to pursue the analysis as well as prepare for the industry that's affected by the bill and then move into public testimony. We may go into specific issues that are in the bill. Interest, it comes to mind, that's something that the administration would like to make their case for. Of course, there's different components of this. If committee members would like additional information, presentations on a particular section of the bill or a particular topic of the bill so that we have clarity, if you would email my office as soon as possible, we'll work to have those presentations available for you. Anything else to come before the committee?
Two minutes, isn't it? I'm sure.
Break it easy. We're back on the record. If I didn't say so, we have reached out to industry and are trying to give them an opportunity to digest what's before us so that they can give us good comments. We'd like to hear from our analysts first so that we understand and that we can challenge both the industry that's involved and the administration that's proposing the changes as to how the financials are affected by the bill that's before us. Any comments from committee members? With that, we're adjourned.
Your host is exiting the conference.